At Rural First, we're the leader in rural construction loans because we don't work here. We work out here. We live rural, which means we know just what you need to build rural. Our dedicated team of loan specialists works with you throughout the construction process. And with our digital tool, you can manage your project all in one place. That's how Rural First gets you closer to what matters. Rural First is a registered trademark of Farm Credit Mid-America. NMLS 407249. Equal housing lender. Loan subject to approval and eligibility. Other terms and conditions may apply. Visit ruralfirst.com for more details.
Now it's time for the last word with Jonathan Capehart filling in for Lawrence. Good evening, Jonathan.
Good evening, Eamon. And I, like you, share your optimism that this upcoming March for Our Lives will, you know, push things forward. We're actually going to have one of the national organizing director of that first March for Our Lives, Maxwell Frost, later on in the show. So I look forward to hearing what he says. Eamon, have a good weekend.
Thank you, my friend. We'll be watching.
All right. It was the wrong decision. That's what the top law enforcement official in Texas admitted today as outrage grows over why it took police so long to stop the gunman at Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, Texas. That gap in police intervention is even more glaring after we learn new details about the timeline today. Minutes after the gunman crashed his vehicle, he was already firing shots outside at the school. A school resource officer who was not on the school grounds heard the 911 call and responded, but actually drove past the shooter, according to officials. At 11:33 a.m., the shooter enters the school and fires more than 100 rounds in 4 minutes. 2 minutes after that, three officers arrive and enter the school, exchanging gunfire with the shooter. By 12:03 p.m., as many as 19 officers are in a hallway inside the school at the same time. One student calls 911 and whispers that she's in room 112. By 12:15 p.m., Border Patrol's tactical unit has arrived. Two federal law enforcement officials tell NBC News that local police instructed them to wait and not to go in after the gunman. After 30 minutes, federal agents overruled that guidance and went in to take down the shooter. After Border Patrol arrived and was told to wait, that same student calls 911 again and says there are 8 to 9 of her classmates still alive. At 12:21 p.m., another student in room 111 calls 911. Gunfire can be heard on that call as law enforcement moves down the hallway. At approximately 12:43, an hour after the shooter entered the school, the student asks the 911 dispatcher to, quote, please send the police now. But it's not until 12:50 p.m., that law enforcement gets the key from the janitor and breaches the door. Today, Stephen McCraw, the head of the Texas Department of Safety, said the decision by the on-scene commander to wait was a mistake.
The question simply is this. It was a 40-minute gap. And if the 911 operators were aware that children were alive in that classroom, why weren't officers notified of that? And if that's the case, why didn't they take action? That's the question. A decision was made that this was a barricaded subject situation. There was time to retrieve the keys and wait for a tactical team with the equipment to go ahead and breach the door and take on the subject at that point. The benefit of hindsight, where I'm sitting now, that of course it was not the right decision. It was the wrong decision, period. There's no excuse for that.
It took 1 hour and 17 minutes from the time the shooter entered the school until the door was breached. Parents were reportedly frantically yelling at police to go inside and help their children, some even wanting to go in themselves. And during that time, multiple calls by frightened students were made to 911 from inside the school. How many children could have been saved in that time? And now we're learning more about what the survivors of the shooting endured, including Mia Cerillo, who covered herself in her dying classmate's blood and pretended to be dead. She told a reporter that the gunman made eye contact with her teacher as he backed her into their classroom, saying, quote, good night, before he shot her. Mia described how the gunman started playing sad music that sounded like, quote, I want people to die music. Texas Republican Governor Greg Abbott today said he was, quote, livid about being, quote, misled about the police response. But that's little comfort to a grieving community left wondering whether those mistakes cost children's lives. Joining us now from Uvalde, Texas, is MSNBC's Yasmin Vesugian. Yasmin, after today's jaw-dropping admission of failure by officials, how are people reacting there in Uvalde?
Angry, frustrated, sad. I think no matter what comes out of this police department here, local police department, federal agents as well, any of the new details that will emerge, accountability, admission of fault, admission that they should have gone in earlier, whatever comes after today, it won't matter. Because leading up to today, there have been so many missteps in the details that they have provided. And then now learning about this essential 1 hour, really, and 20-minute gap from the time at which this shooter entered that school behind me to the time to which he was neutralized. There were students inside that were alive in those classrooms, repeatedly making those phone calls, Jonathan, and you walked through it, right? 1203 was the first phone call that came in from room 112. There were subsequent calls following that, 1210, 1216 from room 111 as well. There were students calling 911. The first 911 call, Jonathan, came in at 1130, saying a crash has happened near the school and there is a man that is armed. And he shot at two individuals that were working at a funeral home that ran to the crash site when they saw the truck crashing in to the ditch behind the school, just three blocks away from here. It took him 5 minutes to make his way to the school, to which he started unleashing fire outside the school grounds. School resource officer, nowhere to be found. I asked at the press conference earlier today, where was the school resource officer? He was off campus. He was not here. He was driving elsewhere. As he learned of the active shooter on campus, he quickly made, and this is their words, made his way to the school, bypassing the shooter who was crouching in a bush area, shooting at the school, and thought a teacher was the shooter, thought a teacher was the one who was armed as he saw that individual outside the school. It was not the teacher. He bypassed the shooter at that point. You mentioned the fact the shooter made his way into the school around 11:32, I believe it was, followed by seven officers, seven. 30 minutes later, 19 were inside the school, 30 minutes later. And it wasn't until 12:50 that they were able to neutralize the shooter. You had BORTEC, you had DHS between 12 and 12:15, according to Julie Ainsley's reporting, as you mentioned, arriving on the scene and told by local police to stand down. DHS at that point was instructed to remove students from windowed areas, windowed classrooms. You had BORTEC standing on the scene with everything, all of the tactical materials that they needed in hand to fight the shooter, and they were told to stand down for 30 minutes until they decided to override what they were being told by local officials and to neutralize the shooter. This community is up in arms. They are angry. They are sad. But here's the worst part, Jonathan. They are not surprised. And I think that's the question we need to ask going forward as well, is they are not surprised by the response of the local police. This community is not surprised by that because of the history they have had with this police as well.
Yasmin, we've known each other a long time. I've never seen you like this. And what you've told us this evening explains why. It is inexplicable, the story that we are all covering and that you are covering from the ground. I'm speechless. And Yasmin, I'm going to let you go before I'm not able to go any further.
It's hard.
In this show. It is so hard. It's bad enough to see babies killed, little children killed. But to hear the negligence of the adults they depended on for their safety is hard to take. And that school resource officer driving past, I would like to hear that person's explanation for why they weren't on their post. It's the whole point of the job, is to be there to protect those kids, and they weren't there. I Yasmin Vesugian, thank
Jonathan,
you.
Jonathan, let me tell you.
Sure.
Let me tell you one more thing. I spoke to the older brother of a little boy named Xavier who lost his life in room 111. 10-year-old boy, loved to dance, loved his family, loved to take care of his little girlfriend, Annabelle, who lost her life as well. A call came in from room 111 at 1216, a 911 call. Xavier was in room 111. His brother wonders, had they reacted, had they gone in, would Xavier be alive today? Would his girlfriend, Annabelle, be alive today? It is that personal. It is that immediate. And it is those questions that need to be answered for these families that have lost everything and lost their future. These kids, these babies that they brought into this world.
Yasmin Vesugian coming to us live from Uvalde, Texas. Thank you very much for that just heartbreaking report. Joining us now, Jim Kavanaugh, retired ATF special agent in charge and an MSNBC terrorism analyst, and Frank Figluzzi, who served as FBI assistant director of counterintelligence. He's an MSNBC national security analyst. Jim, I need you to explain something to us. This active shooter versus barricaded subject, that's the call the on-scene commander made that caused the delay in police breaching the door. How big of a mistake was this? Am I wrong in thinking that this was beyond, like, big doesn't even begin to describe this mistake?
No, I agree with you. I think it's a huge mistake in time and entering the room. I think people get the semantics mixed up. They confuse active shooter training and hostage barricade issues. Let me try to clear it up a little bit. It's an active shooter situation. The training is you move quickly with the when you first get a 3 to 5 officers with long guns to move toward the shooter to eliminate him. What was the initial delay is they run into the breach point, which the doors are locked in the classroom. And it's a problem across America that patrol officers, Jonathan, are not carrying breaching tools. That's another issue, but it's prevalent everywhere. They don't have breaching equipment. But anyway, they reach the breach point. They do have a hostage barricade then. It is not determined by the police. It's determined by the killer. He has live people locked in a room. He's keeping the police out with his rifle. That's a hostage barricade. But the decision, it's occurring inside an active shooter scenario. The decision by the on-scene commander has to be that he knows there's wounded, and probably wounded, even if he doesn't actually know, inside that room who are bleeding. And so time switches to not being on his side. Time is neutral in a tactical operation like this, but it goes against you, it goes for you, it goes back and forth, and the on-scene commander has to realize which way it's tipping on him. And it's tipped against him because wounded or bleeding out. So what he has to do, because the active shooter training is not going to get him through that wall or that door, that doesn't work that way. He now has to breach it with a tactic, a technique that's used by all SWAT and tactical teams called an emergency assault. So what he has to do is quickly form his stack. He has two doors, two classrooms to get in. And as I would do it, I would send two long riflemen around the back to the window. I'd get them on the radio and I'd have one of those long riflemen shoot in to the at the attacker, at the killer, one shot only, and we would initiate the assault on that shot, called a sniper-initiated emergency assault. The reason that has to happen that way is he can kill 30 people in the room in 30 seconds with the gun he has. He can kill 30 people in 30 seconds. So you can't just say, oh, you know, they should have went in, they can bang on the door, they can you know, prod the door with a screwdriver. No, he's just going to kill everyone in there. You're just going to result in their death. So you have to take a few minutes, hesitate, set up an emergency assault, like I describe, I would set up a sniper initiated. But the sniper may miss. The sniper may wound him. A sniper may kill him. But even on that shot, the action happens, and you can beat him from killing the children. So the on-scene commander was not wrong to hesitate. No, using the vernacular of a hostage barricade, there's nothing evil about that. It did flip to that. He was barricaded against there. They needed to breach. What was amazing to me, Jonathan, the chief of the Independent School District Police doesn't have a key to the classroom. There's only six officers on his force, and he doesn't have a key to the classroom. That's crazy. And they should have went in there. Bortax Air 1215, they should have went in within 10 minutes of that. Mm-hmm.
Jim, let me stick with you just for on that, because I was just about to ask you, why did it still take a key from the janitor to open the door?
Yeah, it's not insightful at all. First of all, patrol officers across the country need to have shotgun breaching rounds. They need to have some of these Halligan tools, small hydraulic tools carried in a backpack. They need to be able to get indoors. If they don't have those, they need to have the first hook and ladder that's 3 minutes away on the scene. Those truck company guys can get through any door. You may be in a situation where you don't have the keys or can't get the keys. That can't stop you. You got to breach. You got to get in there. Mm-hmm. You got to move fast. This called for an immediate emergency assault. Now, that doesn't set up in 3 seconds. It's going to take a little bit of coordination, a few minutes to stack that up. But the commander's got to have on his mind, there's people bleeding out in there, and that's my time constraint. Set the assault, because you got to beat his trigger finger on 30 seconds. So I hear a lot of talk, oh, it's just an active shooter. You just got to go in. Well, I don't know how you're going through a brick wall. I don't know how you're going through a door if you don't have breaching equipment or you don't have the key. So you got to get that stuff first, and then you got to launch your emergency assault. So that's the only way it should have worked. That extra 30 minutes it took probably let some of those children bleed to death.
Frank, let me bring you in this and get your view on all this. But in particular, you know, the commanding officer on the scene was the chief of police for the school district. Why didn't someone with more experience take charge? Was that even possible?
Yeah, I think the theme that we've got going with Jim here is that what should have been a hiccup under ideal circumstances turned into a horror show. By that, I mean, Jim and I have both seen elite, highly trained SWAT teams treat this as a speed bump, not a half an hour or an hour of delay. And by that, I mean, we've got to understand that perhaps the wrong person was the on-site commander. Again, as Jim said, someone who leads a six-man school police department is unlikely to be the most qualified person in the area to lead an ongoing mass casualty event, number one. Number two, Jim touched on this. Why do I think it should have been just a hiccup that he's locked himself in and is firing? Because I've seen SWAT teams defeat this when they show up quickly and are fully equipped, shields, Kevlar, ceramic plates to protect their bodies, helmets to protect their heads, snipers, all the breaching tools right there with them. The key to the master key to the school is in hand. None of this happened. And if there's anything that we can take away from this, if there's anybody viewing us tonight, Jonathan, that is part of a school board, police leadership, a concerned parent, you name it, after this holiday weekend, convene a meeting. I don't care if you're in Kansas or Connecticut, and start going through this. Where are breaching equipment? Who's the on-scene commander at a school event? Let's get that out right now. And don't worry about turf or jurisdiction. Who's the most qualified? What SWAT team is going to handle this and get there first and most trained? Where are the keys? Is it the fire department? Go through this. You may think you've got all the solutions. You may think you've exercised this, as happened in Uvalde. But when it happens, are you ready? The time to plan for that is right after the holiday.
It is absolutely appalling that we even have to have this conversation for grade schools. Frank Figluzzi, Jim Kavanaugh, thank you both very much for joining us tonight. We got to go. Coming up, the families in Uvalde are grieving their murdered while wondering if their own police force could have done more to save them. We will talk to a local pastor in Uvalde about how families and the community are coping. And tonight, after this program, Stephanie Ruhle will host a special hour on America's gun violence epidemic. Enough is enough. will air at 11 p.m. Eastern right here on MSNBC.
At Rural First, we're the leader in rural construction loans because we don't work here. We work out here. We live rural, which means we know just what you need to build rural. Our dedicated team of loan specialists works with you throughout the construction process. And with our digital tool, you can manage your project all in one place. That's how Rural First gets you closer to what matters. Rural First is a registered trademark of Farm Credit Mid-America. NMLS 407249. Equal housing lender. Loan subject to approval and eligibility. Other terms and conditions may apply. Visit ruralfirst.com for more details.
Get the latest updates on this year's high-stakes election with MSNBC's How to Win 2024 newsletter. When you subscribe, you'll get expert analysis on key races sent straight to your inbox, including articles written by the host of the How to Win podcast, Jennifer Palmieri. Subscribe today at msnbc.com/win.
If you want to understand how unrelenting the gun violence problem is in America, consider this. We haven't even buried all the victims of our most recent massacre before Uvalde. Vice President Kamala Harris and the second gentleman will travel to Buffalo, New York on Saturday to join the family of 86-year-old Ruth Whitfield, who was one of 10 people murdered by white supremacist extremists at her local supermarket 2 weeks ago. President Joe Biden will visit Uvalde on Sunday to mourn with the families of 19 children and two teachers who were killed just 10 days later. Parents who have to select caskets and plan funerals for their children. Children who should be starting their summer vacations today. Children who had to be identified with DNA because that's what an AR-15 does to a small human body. And families are facing this reality alongside the unfathomable question, could more have been done? Joining us now is Pastor Doug Swimmer of the non-denominational Potter's House Church of Uvalde. Pastor, thank you very much for being here this evening. You've spoken to some of the families. There are so many emotions, shock, grief, anger. Tell us about that.
Well, it's been an ongoing struggle with just dealing with the emotions and the families that I visited and what to give them and what to share with them as a pastor is one that I want to express is hope and love and also that, you know, it's we see the anger in the community, we see the frustration and the confusion, and people do want answers. They want answers to the question why, and so, you know, as a pastor, you know, you try to help them along with that. And sometimes it's just being there for them and with them that brings more comfort than anything. And so we're just, you know, praying with these families and helping them along.
Pastor, you must talk to families with kids in the school system. What are they feeling and expressing?
Fear, frustration, and confusion. These families that are struggling through this and they're looking for the answers. All they want is answers. That's all we want in our community is the answers. And so, you know, with all of this that's coming out, the latest information that has been coming out about everything, you know, it brings a frustration and unsettling throughout the community. But I know this, talking to some of the families today, as I went and visited one house today, as I knocked on the door, she opened it up. She was so thankful that we came to her house and I prayed with them and began just to minister to them and just to help them in that moment. Because sometimes it's moment by moment for us here in Uvalde just to get through these situations and all the information that's coming in and that brings the frustration. And so, you know, these kids that are having to deal with the tragedy of all of this, they have to live through this and you know, to give them the answer of hope. That's why I'm in this community. I've been here over, you know, 15 years at the Potter's House Christian Fellowship Church. And we're here to give them hope And through all of this, Uvalde is Uvalde strong. We'll get through this, and we'll fight through everything that is happening.
Pastor Doug Swimmer, we are very sorry for your community. I want to thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Coming up, children wearing the photos of the Uvalde victims stood outside the NRA's celebration of deadly weapons today, where Donald Trump, Ted Cruz, and other Republicans laid out their response to mass murders in America. More guns. That's next.
Ultimately, as we all know, what stops armed bad guys is armed good guys.
Unless they're not on the school premises. But anyway, that was Texas Senator Ted Cruz parroting the Republican fantasy that has been thoroughly and completely debunked by what happened at Robb Elementary School Tuesday, when 19 children and two teachers were shot to death by an 18-year-old with an AR-15 and 315 bullets in the school with him, with plenty of armed police officers on scene. Texas Senator John Cornyn and Congressman Dan Crenshaw skipped it. Texas Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick backed out as well, issuing a statement saying he, quote, would not want my appearance today to bring any additional pain or grief to the families and all those suffering in Uvalde. But if guns aren't the problem, why would attending a gun celebration cause anyone additional pain or grief? Donald Trump, of course, never questioned going, and he took a swipe at Texas Republican Governor Greg Abbott, spent time today in Uvalde, where children were just massacred.
Unlike some, I didn't disappoint you by not showing up. In addition, classroom doors should be hardened to make them lockable from the inside and closed to intruders from the outside. Surely we can all agree our school should not be the softest target. Our school should be the single hardest target in our country.
For as ignorant as Trump obviously is, his comments and Senator Cruz's are actually pretty reflective of how incoherent the Republicans' blame everything but the guns mantra is. Outside the convention hall, the message from the hundreds of protesters who showed up was clear.
Shame on you!
Shame on you!
Shame on you! Shame on you! Shame on you!
Joining us now from Houston, Texas is NBC News senior investigative reporter Mike Hixenbaum. Mike, I'm so glad we have you on tonight, Mike, because we often just get a sanitized version of what actually happens inside the schools during these types of events. But you actually spoke to a teacher who was in that school listening to those children as they screamed for their lives. Good Lord, Mike. Tell us what she told you.
I spoke with a teacher, just over 24 hours after the shooting. I stood on her front porch and she described for me hearing the gunshots. And knowing right away what that meant, and running and locking her door, getting her kids under their desks, urging them to be quiet, begging them to be quiet, and then sitting on the floor in the center of the room as some of them cried, and just waited for what she described as the longest 35 minutes of her life, as they could hear children down the hall wailing. And she just told her kids to pray until officers finally came and broke out the glass, and she was able to help each of her kids out.
There's nothing more painful than hearing a terrified child scream. But to know that they're screaming because there's a murderer in the classroom is just, it's beyond. Mike, the teacher you spoke to, she made sure to make this point before your interview ended. She told you, and I want to quote, I want you to say this in your article. Our children did not deserve this. They were loved, not only by their families, but by their family at school. Mike, why was it important, so important for her to make that point?
In a year when teachers across the country are being accused by some of the people you just played at the NRA conference of it, wanting to harm children by indoctrinating them, by teaching white children to hate themselves. In a year when teachers have become vilified, she wanted the world to know that she did everything she could to protect those kids because she loves them like they're her own kids. And she really wanted me to share that message with anyone who will listen.
Mike, I have to go, but real quickly, how are you doing? This is not an easy story.
I'm okay. I'm home. Okay. I'm back home with my four kids, and I'm going to take some time off just to rest and hug them.
Mike Hicks and Bob, thank you very much.
Thanks.
The NRA would have you believe that they speak for half of America and certainly for every gun owner. This is not true. For half of the United States Senate, sure. For the entire Republican congressional delegation, sure. But new polling conducted after the massacre in Uvalde found that 65% of Americans support stricter gun control laws. Here's a letter to the editor from the Kansas City Star in Red State, Missouri. Jeffrey from Overland Park writes, I am a gun owner. I believe in the right to bear arms. Our Second Amendment calls for a well-regulated militia. Well, where on earth are the regulations? It is unconscionable that an 18-year-old can walk into a store and purchase not one but two assault rifles with virtually no checks in place. Joe Manchin says this time feels different because he has grandchildren. Prove it. Susan Collins and Mitt Romney want to do something. Then do it. Let's have a vote and get every senator on the record. And then after that, it's up to us, the voters, to decide what we will do. Joining us now is the man who wants to represent the people who wrote those letters in the United States Senate. Lucas Kuntz is a Democratic candidate for U.S. Senate from Missouri and a U.S. Marine veteran. Lucas, thank you very much for being here. Let me first get your reaction to what happened this week. You're a father. You've got two kids who aren't much younger than the kids who were tragically murdered in that school. How does that make you feel?
It makes me feel terrible. And listening to Mike talk, it just brings it all back. You know, when I deployed to Afghanistan, the people who sent us there, they told us that we were there to keep terrorism at bay. They told us we were there to keep our homes, our families, and our children safe so that only terrorists would be overseas. And now those same people, because they're unwilling or unable to act in Washington, are telling me that despite those deployments, I have to come back here while my kids are doing shooting drills at school. I have to come back. I have to look my 6-year-old and my 8-year-old in the eye, and I have to tell them that it didn't work, that their school may become a war zone at any time. It's absolutely insane.
I mean, that's an excellent point you made, Lucas, about being sent overseas to keep the terrorists over there so they don't harm us here. And we're being terrorized by mass shooting after mass shooting. As a Marine veteran and a gun owner, what goes through your head when you hear some of the details about what the shooters, the AR-15, a literal weapon of war, he was able to get this gun and was able to do what he did to innocent children? Why would an 18-year-old need a gun like that?
It's absolutely terrible. You know, when 18-year-olds join, look, we're used to 18-year-olds getting assault rifles in the Marine Corps, right? It happens every single day. And you just don't hand an 18-year-old an assault rifle and a pile of ammo and tell him to figure it out or to do whatever he wants to do with it. You make sure they go through training. You make sure they go through observation. They go through all sorts of stuff to make sure that they're able to safely handle that weapon and not do anything bad with it. It's unbelievable that we can just roll out here without even comprehensive background checks in this country. And, you know, you talk about what people in Missouri want. People in Missouri, they want the exact same thing that people around this country that want. Republicans, Democrats, independents, gun owners, and non-gun owners, They all want comprehensive background checks, red flag laws, ways to make sure that these weapons, weapons of war, stay out of the hands of criminals and terrorists.
That's an excellent way to end this interview, Lucas Kunz. Thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Absolutely.
Coming up, do you think a teenager who isn't allowed to drink should be able to buy any weapon of war with basically no impediment? Neither does most of America. And we could do something about it immediately. That's next.
At Rural First, we're the leader in rural construction loans because we don't work here. We work out here. We live rural, which means we know just what you need to build rural. Our dedicated team of loan specialists works with you throughout the construction process. And with our digital tool, you can manage your project all in one place. That's how Rural First gets you closer to what matters. Rural First is a registered trademark of Farm Credit Mid-America. NMLS 407249. Equal housing lender. Loan subject to approval and eligibility. Other terms and conditions may apply. Visit ruralfirst.com for more details.
Hey everyone, it's MSNBC's Chris Hayes. For the first time since 1892, we have an election in which both candidates have presidential records. It's a chance to take a hard look at what Joe Biden and Donald Trump have actually done as president. On a special Why Is This Happening podcast series called With Pod 2024, The Stakes, I'm talking to experts about the two candidates' records on specific policy areas like immigration, taxes, climate, and more. So you know what's at stake come November. Search for Why Is This Happening and follow.
The idea that an 18-year-old kid can walk into a gun store and buy two assault weapons is just wrong.
19 children and two teachers in Uvalde were killed by weapons their killer bought for his 18th birthday. According to the Giffords Law Center, only six states, Florida, Washington, Vermont, California, Illinois, and Hawaii, have increased the minimum age to purchase assault rifles from 18 to 21 years old. In a new Reuters Ipsos poll, 72% said they would support raising the age to buy a gun from 18 to 21. Joining us now is Democratic Congressman Anthony Brown of Maryland. He's a 30-year Army veteran and the vice chair of the House Armed Services Committee. Congressman, great to see you. Let's listen to what Governor Greg Abbott had to say when asked today if he would consider imposing a ban on 18-year-olds buying assault rifles.
For a century and a half, 18-year-olds could buy rifles, and we didn't have school shootings, but we do now. Maybe we're focusing our attention on the wrong thing.
Congressman, your reaction to the governor?
He couldn't be more wrong. I mean, as you mentioned, you know, 72%+ of Americans support raising the age to buy a semi-automatic rifle. This is an assault weapon to 21. Already, federal law requires you to be 21 to buy a handgun. Look, I was a soldier for 30 years. I went to Iraq. I know the damage, the destruction of these semi-automatic rifles. We don't need them in our neighborhoods and our communities, period. That's why states like Maryland have banned them altogether. But if we can't ban assault weapons, it's certainly reasonable to raise the age to 21, the same age that we have for a handgun. We know that one in every eight mass shootings includes an 18 to 20-year-old. We also know that more than 60% of mass shootings include assault rifles. So it only makes sense. It doesn't solve everything, but it's an important piece of the puzzle if we are going to solve this mass shooting, taking of lives, 31 in the last 10 days in Buffalo and Uvalde, both by shooters under 21, 18 years old, with semi-automatic rifles. We need to be urgent, and Congress has to act with a sense of urgency.
But Congressman, according to the new Reuters Ipsos poll, 49% said they were not confident that lawmakers would strengthen gun laws this year. Only 35% said they were confident. After two mass shootings in 10 days, do you think anything will be different this time?
Look, what I think is that Congress has to come back to Washington, and we need to do our level best to raise the age to 21 for semi-automatic rifles, assault weapons. We have to pass a red flag law, a national standard, and we have to pass universal background checks. Now, we've done the background checks and the red flag law. We've already gotten those out of the House in the past. We've got to come back. We've got to work with the Senate to make sure that they get it done. Look, am I confident? Look, if history is any indication of what to expect in the next few months, I'm not optimistic. But I'll tell you right now, as a public official who is elected to fight for people, to fight for safe neighborhoods, I'm going back to Washington intent, hell bent on making sure I do everything I can with my colleagues to pass meaningful gun safety regulation.
Congressman Anthony Brown of Maryland, thank you very much for joining us tonight. Coming up, change is coming. Might not happen this time, but today's survivors of mass shootings, today's school children being locked down, doing lockdown drills, are tomorrow's voters and lawmakers. We'll meet one of them next.
This isn't a one-off, you know, this happened out of the blue. This is an issue. It's a growing issue. You know, I've got six children. My children are growing up in a world much different than you and I grew up in. And we got to be aware of that.
Since the Columbine massacre in 1999, there have been more than 300 school shootings across the United States. The current generation has never known school to be a completely safe place. They've grown up with school shootings, lockdown drills, and protesting school violence. And today's school kids will be tomorrow's elected officials. Joining us now is Maxwell Alejandro Frost, Democratic candidate for Congress representing Florida's 10th District. He is a former organizing director for the group March for Our Lives. Maxwell, I sort of hesitate to say great to see you again, but we have met on my Sunday show, so it is good to see you. But Maxwell, after the murder of 19 children and two teachers in Uvalde, what legislation would you push for in Congress to try to prevent these mass murders in school from happening?
There's a lot of different legislation we need to pass, but we need to get something done that can make a huge difference that the majority of Americans, gun owners included, are for, and that is universal background checks. We need, you know, we saw today folks advocating and protesting in Texas, and that's the type of advocacy we need. You know, I got involved in this fight at 15 years old after Sandy Hook. It's been 10 years. People are fed up and they want to see action, and this time will be different because it has to be. Every day we lose 100 lives. So I would say universal background checks.
Mm-hmm. The Associated Press interviewed an Ohio teacher who spoke with her sixth graders the day after the Uvalde mass murder. She told AP, quote, "Some students said they were sad. Some were dismayed. The 19 slain children were so young. After a few minutes, though, the conversation fizzled. Students were ready to move on with their day." Maxwell, what would you say to students who've grown up with the reality of school shootings who are seemingly numb to these tragedies?
What I would say is we cannot allow ourselves to become numb. Like I said, every day we lose 100 people. And it's easy when we turn on the news and we see these tragedies every day to become numb. But recognize that behind every number, there is a beautiful human being, someone with loved ones and families and stories. And so that's why this time has to be different and why we have to continue to fight. People are tired of the violence. We deserve the right to live fear, free of the fear of being gunned down. And we deserve that by virtue of being human beings. And my generation is going to make sure that this stops in our lifetime. And we're going to continue to fight no matter what.
You know, your generation is what gives me hope, especially with the March for Our Lives. And I'm just wondering, do the protests that we saw outside the NRA convention, do they give you hope that maybe this time things will change?
They 100% give me hope, Jonathan. These are folks that are mourning. In the midst of this mourning, they said, we need to go out to demand that we need a change in our country right now. We're tired of the violence, and we want to live in a world where we can live free of gun violence. And people are here to do that work right now. It gives me an incredible amount of hope. We're going to see marches all across the country, and we're going to continue to ensure that we keep this fight alive and don't become numb to it.
Maxwell Alejandro Frost, thank you very much for coming to The Last Word. And that is tonight's Last Word. I'm Jonathan Capehart. I'll see you on the Sunday show Sunday morning at 10 a.m. Eastern right here on MSNBC.
At Rural First, we're the leader in rural construction loans because we don't work here. We work out here. We live rural, which means we know just what you need to build rural. Our dedicated team of loan specialists works with you throughout the construction process. And with our digital tool, you can manage your project all in one place. That's how Rural First gets you closer to what matters. Rural First is a registered trademark of Farm Credit Mid-America. NMLS 407249. Equal housing lender. Loan subject to approval and eligibility. Other terms and conditions may apply. Visit ruralfirst.com for more details.